How's it going? Hope you're doing all right. I'm really excited for this episode. If you're new to this podcast, it's all about diving deep into the music and chatting to some of my favourite unsigned artists, some of my favourite unsigned bands, and just seeing all the new stuff that they've got and following them on their careers. For this episode, I'm chatting to Rob Clements. He's the lead singer and guitarist from The Goodwater. They're a Birmingham-based trio. They've been going since about 2016, and I think they're absolutely sick. It's really fuzzy guitars. You've got these vintage rock organs that creep in. They also kind of have this signature hypnotic drum sound, I'd say, and it all adds into this unique style of psychedelic indie pop. If you're into your 60s psych, like The Coral or certainly later Beatles stuff, you'll be all over what these guys do. And also, they're getting loads of amazing radio play at the minute. Steve Lamacq from BBC Six Music is all about them. They've also got plenty of play from BBC Introducing in the West and BBC Introducing Hereford and Worcester as well. So some real exciting times for these guys ahead. We're chatting all about their new single. It's called Breadcrumbs. I think if you're into your rock in any way, this is essential. As always, please leave a review, please leave a rating, and feel free to share away, because any little bit of love that you could share to this passion project of mine would be massively appreciated. Man, we've got so much to catch up on. Firstly, like, how are you? Because I've not spoken to you in so long. We've both been doing life and doing different things, and I know for a fact I've been abroad doing bits and pieces. What's been going on?
So, I mean, yeah, band-wise, you know, we've been gigging and writing songs and doing all the usual things that bands do, I guess. And then on a personal sort of level, me and my wife Jennifer have had a child. I've got a son called James.
Amazing! Congratulations.
So, thank you. He was actually born about 10 days before the first lockdown. So again, you know, he'd be three this year. So it's that also seems like a long time. So he obviously keeps me pretty busy with things, as you can imagine.
Well, this is a great place to start off, because this has given me a few things I want to chat to you about. I suppose firstly with, you know, you having James just before lockdown, in a weird way, did that help you out in lockdown? Did it give you something to kind of focus on? Was it something that cut through all the noise and the chaos and the madness that was going on, and it just brought everything down to basics?
100%, yeah, definitely. It was almost, it was kind of perfect timing in a weird way. The only downside was that we couldn't have visitors coming in. So at times it did feel, you know, we were quite isolated, if you'll excuse the pun, you know, because, you know, it is good in that situation. It is good to have help from, you know, friends and family and stuff when you do have those sleepless nights and things. But also it was incredible because I had like the longest paternity leave in history. Like I was off, I think, for a few days before James was born, and they just didn't go back to work for like 6 months. It was insane. It was ridiculous. So yeah, there were, and, you know, having that sort of connection, you know, with James in those sort of early years, it obviously did change our relationship. I think it must have done, you know, for the better, definitely. But yes, it was good in that respect. Yeah.
Now, when I was growing up, I grew up on some of the albums off the top of my head. By the way, the Red Hot Chili Peppers. My mum and dad also brought me up listening to like Janet Jackson, Velvet Rope, Jack Johnson, In Between Dreams, yep. Just some classic albums. And that was so important for me, I think, growing up, making music myself, making music in a band myself. And I've always thought since, right, there would be so much pressure on me in the future when it comes to like introducing my child, my children, to music for the first time. Because I'm like, what do I play them growing up? Because I don't want to overly influence them, but I also kind of want to influence them because, you know, I want to show them all this great music. Yeah. Have you started kind of going down that path yet? Thinking, right, what am I introducing James to with music? Because I suppose he's three, so maybe starting to get to that age, I don't know.
You're 100% right. I mean, I think for the first 12 months, it's just hard. Like, it's just a blur. It's just, like you say, you know, those sleepless nights, those all that crazy stuff. So for the first kind of year, I didn't really give it too much thought. We're just kind of, you know, trying to stay afloat. But then after that, yeah, you've really hit the nail on the head there. It's kind of this background pressure of like being a musician, and you have that conversation with people as well, because everyone knows what you do for a job, and they're like, oh, have you started teaching James guitar yet, have you started on it? And I'm like, no, of course I haven't, he's tiny, you know. But actually it's something that I've been thinking about, and obviously we play music all the time in the house. We've got, you know, an Alexa in most rooms, like people have these days, so you know the radio's always on, and I'm always kind of playing, you know, just playlists and things, as Spotify people, things that people send me. But actually recently, which has really warmed my heart, it's one of the most amazing things that's happened so far, is he's actually been asking to play my music, which has been really, really cool. He's sort of started stringing words together. He can almost kind of do sentences, but it's sort of in the stage where he's just kind of grouping words together, and he's managed to say, Alexa, good water, breadcrumbs.
No way.
And he plays breadcrumbs on Alexa all by himself, and it is like the most, you know, the pride that oozes out of me is unreal, you know.
Mate, I bet. I mean, if that isn't a pitch for the new song, I don't know what is. That's absolute quality advertising.
Endorsed by James, age 3. Yeah.
Oh, bless him, man. So yeah, I want to get on to breadcrumbs in a sec, because I love it. And you know, the beauty of just this podcast just being my own thing is that I suppose I only ever get to chat to people who are making music that I genuinely really vibe with, which is really nice, because you know, you don't have to flog something that you don't want to flog. You just talk about what you're into. I guess my entry point into your music as the Good Water was, right, I went to go and see you live in Birmingham, and for the life of me, this is how long ago it was, because I reckon it was like 7 or 8 years ago, but I can't for the life of me remember where it was. It was somewhere in Digbeth. It was almost like under a bridge or something like that.
Yeah, I think it was in Digbeth. I think it was a place, if I remember correctly, I think it was probably a place called Green Street. And did you come with Jacob, your brother?
I came with my brother Jacob. I came with my mate Jay as well. Because for context, we were in a band at the time, my brother and my mate. And you actually taught guitar lessons to my mate Jay. And that's how we kind of got to know each other and how we linked up. And then we ended up coming to see your band. And I was blown away, because, I anticipated you'd be a sick musician. I already liked the songs. But for me, it was that live experience. And I suppose you do put the emphasis on an experience as the Good Water. It was the venue. It was the light display. So can you explain a little bit more about sort of the effort you guys put into a live show and what some of the big considerations are when you go into something like that?
Yeah, 100%. I think actually, just as you were talking, then I was racking my brain trying to think when that actually was. That was actually our very first gig that you came to, which is why it was such a long time ago.
Was it actually?
It was, yeah.
Dude, so that must have been like, what, 2016, 2017?
I think it was, yeah. Which feels like a lifetime ago now. But for people that don't know that much about the band, the Good Water actually started off as a two-piece with just me and my friend Tom. Tom, who plays drums. We'd been in different bands, and we'd been in bands as well together, kind of after we met at college. And I think that Green Street show was our very, very first gig. So we kind of we did as much as we can. We kind of pulled out all the stops really for that first show, because we'd been sort of writing songs together for, I don't know, probably about 6 months, maybe even 12 months before we actually did a gig. But this kind of idea, the thing that you were getting at in your question there, the idea of it being more of an experience than just a gig was something that we were really passionate about, especially for that first show that we did. It was more about, sort of the experience that people felt through the whole entire night, not just, sort of coming to watch us at a grotty little pub in Birmingham somewhere. So we kind of... we kind of recruited sort of a little team around us, I suppose. A guy called Tim Felton, who's an amazing musician. He was in a band called Broadcast through the 90s. If people haven't heard of that band, they should check out Broadcast. Definitely, they're an amazing band. We got him doing some sound for us because he's just a great musician. We had a guy called Mikey doing the lighting show for us. A guy called Joe Potts doing some live kind of visuals with projectors and things. And this awesome kind of big warehouse space in the middle of Digbeth, kind of like an arts sort of space. So having kind of all those sort of elements to the night and booking kind of bands and artists and things sort of to support us during the night as well, was kind of just as important as just our show, you know, as just us playing the songs that we've written. So we like to feel that it kind of became more about the night and the experience than just the two of us playing our songs, you know.
For sure. And it was at the time only two of you as well. And I was just amazed at how much noise you got out into the room, just, you know, guitar and drums essentially. How do you go about getting the guitar sound that you get? And I'll get on to the studio recordings in a sec, because that's a whole different ballgame. What's your live setup?
As I said, I'll kind of without, you know, sort of delving too deep into the history of everything we've done over the last kind of 8 years, when we were a two-piece, obviously Tom was playing drums and we both sing. Sort of guitar wise, I was running kind of a 3-amp kind of setup. I'd run my guitar in stereo, so I'd go through two sort of guitar amps, and then I'd run through a bass amp as well with a pitch shifter in. So when I'm kind of playing riffs and sort of lead lines and things, that sort of pitch shifter would add that kind of that big bottom end to the sound. That's what happened when we were a two-piece. And then when we met Stu, our keyboard player, sort of jumping on a few years from that, we obviously wanted Stu to come in and kind of play some cool kind of 60s organ sounds and some kind of vintage synth kind of sounds. But then Stu being Stu, he really loves the Doors, as do I. Rob, instead of you trying to do all this stuff, you know, you're singing, you're playing bass lines, you're playing chords, you're playing lead lines, like you're stretching yourself really thin, which I was. He said, why don't I do kind of a Doors Ray Manzarek kind of thing and play the bass with his left hand on like a synth? So that kind of became the new kind of three-piece Good Water, where I was just playing guitar and singing. Tom was on drums and singing, and then Stu was doing the bass with his left hand and then all the organ synthy stuff with his right hand, which is insane to see when he does it live, because he's, you know, he's spinning plates basically. It's nuts. But that was a massive deal to me, not only to have a third person in to create more textures and things, but it took a lot of the pressure off myself. Because it was like one less thing for me to think about. So it kind of let me just concentrate on the performance a little bit more, I think, which was a massive help, you know.
I was going to say that. And sound wise, did that free you up into kind of venturing into different sonics, you know, and trying out other things that maybe you wouldn't have done before because you worried about kind of the low end?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, 100%. I mean, I was looking back on it now, I was massively restricted with what I could do. But I suppose at the time it was just kind of fun, because, you know, I'd never been in a two-piece band before. So it was kind of just fun to have those restrictions. But after, you know, sort of 2 or 3 years of you know, giant pedal boards all being patched different ways, and, you know, playing through three different amps at the same time, which has a headache as far as ground loops and things are concerned, all of a sudden to have Stu come along to take that element off me, it was amazing. I was blitzing out guitar solos left, right and center, which is probably why, you know, when Stu joined the band, most of our songs had like, you know, 10 minute guitar solos in them, because all of a sudden I was just like free, you know, just free to do whatever.
I suppose at the heart of it, you are a guitarist, you know, you are someone that likes to plug in and play, and getting that kind of breathing space to just shred, that must have been super liberating. And probably did that help out your songwriting as well, like moving on from the sound side of things? you probably just felt more inspired song-wise because you had just more to choose from.
That's exactly it, yeah, sort of. And apart from the kind of the freedom that I explained, that kind of that Stu kind of gave me, really, it was about more textures that we could add as well. So Stu's sort of a big fan of kind of vintage synths. He's got a lovely old Juno 6. So yeah, not only kind of from a performance and a guitar ripping kind of solo aspect, but yeah, adding more textures, and me kind of, so Stu kind of adding more things with the keys, and then sort of freeing my mind up as well to get more kind of into guitar pedals and modulation and things like that. So yeah, I think it definitely had a positive effect, yeah, massively.
When it comes to your pedals, What are you using at the minute? What's the setup there?
It's a fluid kind of situation, really. I think most people's pedal boards are. It changes from 1 month, sometimes 1 week to the next, depending on what you find on YouTube. I'm a big watcher of a show called That Pedal Show, which, if anyone's into guitar pedals, I am sure they've come across before. Dan and Mick, who host the show, are just absolute experts when it comes to pedals and just sonics in general, so a lot of my sort of ideas kind of come from those guys, and just experimenting with things. I mean, I'm a big fan of fuzz. I think anyone that's listened to any Good Water songs will think that's pretty obvious. So I've got, I don't know, 4 or 5 or maybe even 6 fuzz pedals, which is just ridiculous. Like, nobody needs that many fuzz pedals.
But you're a guitarist. You do. Because I've been in the same boat. I get it.
You get it. That's it. That's why I love having chats with you, because you being a musician yourself, you understand the idiosyncrasies of of musicians that spend thousands and thousands of pounds on fuzz pedals. But yeah, so fuzz is a big thing for me. Also, yeah, delay and modulation. A few years ago, I bought a Strymon Volante, which is kind of, this sort of retro, I forgot a really good tagline Strymon have for this particular pedal. And it's, what was it? Analog heart with a digital brain, which I just thought was, it sums up this pedal perfectly. So it's all analog, it's all beautiful analog vintage kind of delay sounds, but it's all really programmable, so you can really get stuck into kind of the kind of patches and the way things work. So it's one of these pedals that you can get really technical with.
Right, let's talk breadcrumbs then, because I mean, is that used at the start of that song? Well, throughout, but at the start it's kind of just like this delayed digital sounds, but it's just on its own, it's quite isolated.
So that is that's actually a tremolo that's kind of just that kind of chopping up the fuzz. Yeah, so I think if I cast my memory back, I think I'm using an Analog Man Sunface fuzz, I think, for the intro of that. So it's basically just my fuzz pedal, everything's on 10, the amp's cranked up, it's feeding back, it's going mad, and then you introduce that sort of square wave tremolo pedal, and it basically just chops your feedback up from, instead of your feedback just going meh, it's now going and then stick some modulation on there, and you're moving in and out and you're wobbling all over the place, man. And that was, yeah, so technically it's probably got a bit of delay on because I just can't help myself. I'm sure it's got a bit of delay on there as well, but the main intro is a tremolo pedal on that one, yeah.
know what I found so refreshing about Breadcrumbs, really diving into the song now, is, and I mean this respectfully, there's so much space for the music. Vocally, you've got some R's, you've got some stunning harmonies, but, you know, there's nothing in the way of, like, a soaring vocal chorus. There's nothing in the way in terms of a vocal hook. And I really loved that. I loved how you just kind of got stuck into this psychedelic 60s sort of sound. So where did that idea come about? Did you try and put vocals on it and then thought, ah, do you know what, let's sack it off? Or was that the intention from the start to just create this instrumental?
Breadcrumbs was never really meant to be a single, I don't think. It was just a jam that we had, and we've had it knocking around for quite a few years, if I'm totally honest. But it's always been, and still is actually, the highlight of the live set. It's you know, you have one of those tracks in the set, you just know it's the pinnacle of the set, and it's almost like all the other songs kind of just are based around that track. It almost to emphasize the pinnacle of the set, which is Breadcrumbs, you know. So we'd always love playing this track live, but you're exactly right, because there's no vocal to it, there's no big chorus that, you know, everyone can sing along to. We never really entertained the idea of it being a single. And it was actually, without going off on too much of a tangent here, I sort of reconnected 12 months ago with my old manager, a guy called Dylan White, who is an absolute legend in the music industry. A lot of people know him. I won't list his credentials now because I'll be here all day, but he's done some amazing things with some really huge bands. He managed my old band, Pint Shot Riot, and we sort of reconnected over the last 12 months. Anyway, he said, "Oh, send me your stuff, Rob. Send me your stuff. Like, I want to hear what the Good War have been up to." So I sent him all our demos and all our tracks, and Breadcrumbs was obviously in the mix. And he came back to me within, you know, less than 24 hours and just said, "Breadcrumbs, Breadcrumbs is the next single. Breadcrumbs, you've got to do Bread." And I was like, "Really?" I said, "There's no vocals to it. Are you mad? Like, it can't be a single. It's just an instrumental." He was like, "No." He said, "It's got, you know, it has got something. It's got that energy. I can't sort of put my finger on it, but it has got something." And I said, "Okay." I trust his judgment. You know, like I said, he's been in the industry for 30 odd years. So I was like, "Yeah, all right, let's do it." And between myself and Dylan, we actually kind of did a bit of an edit. So he's a radio plugger by trade, so he's all about the radio edit. You know, he loves the radio edit. So together we kind of we took the track and we didn't change anything sonically, just moved a few things around. And actually, if you listen to the version that we've released, there's actually two sets of the oohs and ahs. There only used to be one section of the oohs and ahs, and Dylan was like, no, even though that's just the one vocal, it is quite hooky. He said, "You've got to do that twice, you know." So we ended up tweaking the edit a little bit and kind of adding that extra set of vocals in kind of towards the end. And now that just feels so right now, because we've been playing it that way for, well, yeah, probably 12 months or so now. So so that is the track, really. But thanks to Dylan sort of jumping back on board again and us reconnecting, the song kind of changed a little bit, but changed for the better, I think.
It sounds very expansive. It sounds like you're kind of leaving no stone unturned when it comes to really trying to push your instruments as far as they'll go. Certainly you on guitar. It's so razor sharp in terms of the structure, in terms of where you're going with the song. And like you say, you know, with being obsessed with radio edits, I can hear that. It sounds very trim and you get to the point, but also it sounds like this jam. It sounds like the sort of thing that I can imagine you just rip out at the end of a set or something. So I love the fact that that was very deliberate. Was that kind of the trick with this song?
Yes, again, 100%. Again, this is why I love talking to you, because of your experience as a musician and everything you do with radio as well. You kind of pick up on these things that probably nobody else would as an interviewer, especially. So you've absolutely hit the nail on the head. So when Dylan first came to me with this, he was like, "We've got to do an edit." And Breadcrumbs is quite a precious song for the three of us in the band, because as I said, it's the pinnacle of our live kind of set. It always goes off. And we feel really passionate about that particular track. So yeah, when Dylan came to us, he was like, "Yeah, I love it, but it needs an edit." We were like, no. It's like, it's perfect as it is. Because as you said, it's kind of the whole idea of the track was it's meant to kind of be this journey. starting off with this kind of as we mentioned, that kind of singularity, that kind of that tremolo, bap 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 bap, and it kind of growing from that point, and taking you on this this kind of crazy journey through space and out the other end. It was always meant to be that sort of track. So when Dylan kind of came on board as the radio guy, and he was like, "We need to make this a radio edit," it was hard to come to terms with, and it was almost like I kind of had to separate my head from the artist kind of head to my sensible producer head, which was a tricky thing to do. But as I said, I trust Dylan's judgment, to the nth degree. So I kind of just had to switch off.
For sure, I get you. It's almost like you don't want the soul to be ripped out of it, do you? I'd be interested to know how you actually recorded that. What was the situation? Was it like fully multi-tracked all the way, or were there moments where you were like in the same room?
I appreciate you saying that first and foremost, because I did a lot of the production myself on this one. So I'm really glad you said that.
Good man.
We've recorded over in a studio called RML Studios over in Wolverhampton with a guy called Ryan Pinson, who's a lovely guy. Couldn't imagine working with anyone else at the moment. He just really gets us, gets our sound, and he's just the loveliest guy to work with. So when we came to record Breadcrumbs, because it's such a live track, we wanted to do as much of it live as we possibly could. So the drums and the main kind of fuzz guitar part and the organ part and the kind of the synth bass on there, that was all recorded live, all in the same room, all at the same time, which, as you said, I think gives it that kind of live, kind of passionate, kind of locked in kind of vibe. But then because we are just a three piece and we don't really have a bass player, there was a few little bits that I added in.
Quick look on your social media as well, and it looks like you've got some decent radio play. I saw that Amazing Radio have played Breadcrumbs, also Six Music as well. That's big. That's massive. Congratulations.
That is. Thank you very much. That is pretty big. Yeah, we were pretty chuffed with that. We all feel really passionately about that particular song. It sort of means a lot to us, as a band, and we knew that it was something a bit special. In fact, I will just mention this just quick while we're talking about radio plays, about BBC introducing. I don't know if you heard the news that came out a few weeks ago about BBC introducing it all being scaled back. I'm sure you have.
I've not actually posted anything on my social media about it yet. I've gone and signed the petitions that are going around, but I've not actually really spoken about it. It's really upsetting, not least because as a radio presenter, I know of people who present introducing shows. The fact that talented broadcasters who really champion music from their local patch, that genuinely level up local bands, local artists who are super talented, the fact that they might be losing shows sucks so bad. But, you know, it's the artist fundamentally. And I remember when we, in my band, when we were like 15, 16, there was a period of time that all we wanted was to get BBC Introducing play. And we finally got it. We got played on BBC Hereford and Worcestershire with Andrew Marsden. And we also got some airplay on BBC Radio Leeds, I think it was. And we were so excited. And we ended up going to do live sessions for BBC Introducing. Got chatting to other artists who, you know, we'd never heard of before. They invited us onto the back of some of their gigs. So we ended up playing extra gigs. We got extra exposure. We got extra followers because people had heard us and thought, oh, I really like those guys. I'm going to check them out. And what is so criminal is that that could potentially be totally taken away from hardworking artists who deserve the recognition, who have talent. And it creates this void. It creates this space in the middle because you've got grassroots musicians who are wanting to get noticed. But then you've got people sort of more at the top who have connections, who have an in, that will get picked up. So it's that middle space. How do you navigate that? It's awful. It's an absolute travesty for radio and for music, for musicians in general. I've just gone off on one. What were you going to say, sorry, mate?
No, that's fine. And to be honest, mate, I really appreciate your sort of your input on that. And apologies if I kind of sprung that on you a little bit, but no, I just felt like I couldn't sort of talk about Six Music and the BBC plays and things we've got without kind of mentioning that, because you're exactly right. It will be, if these cuts end up happening, it will be a massive travesty for especially for bands and artists like us. But like you said, also for the DJs and the producers. Like Andrew Marsden has been amazing. I mean, our relationship goes way, way, way back to when I was in older bands, that sort of grassroots level when you first just starting out. Andrew Marsden was a champion for bands I've been in previously, and for Good Water Tracks. Every single song that we've released, Andrew Marsden and his team have got behind and they've played it multiple times. And that is never lost on me. That distance, like that kind of grey area between bands just playing pubs and clubs and the huge big bands that are, you know, doing big tours and have lots of revenue coming in and lots of fans, that grey area, that middle ground, it's hard enough to navigate at the best of times, knowing where to go, knowing who to speak to, knowing what booking agents to use, blah blah blah, all that nonsense that you have to do. And BBC Introducing were champions, or still are champions, of that middle ground.